Hi, my name is Torin Yock. It's a pleasure to be here with you virtually for the Astro Refresher Pediatrics portion. I appreciate being invited by Dr. Kuhn and the whole Astro Refresher team. I wish I could be there in person, but it is what it is. Let's move forward. We'll be covering a lot of information. So, first disclosure, most pertinent, as I have way too many slides, and also I am technologically challenged. So bear with me. This is my third attempt at recording this, and hopefully it'll go better than the others. Learning objectives. Basically, we're going to cover a lot of information, but if you have further questions or other resources that you need, the disease PDQs for the health professionals are excellent, and the COG protocols are also excellent, but you also need a username and login, as a login and password to that, which you can hopefully get from one of your colleagues at your institution. All right, so this is the outline of the tumors that we're going to cover. Only briefly about cancer epidemiology. Childhood cancer is less than 1% of all cancers in the United States. There's over 12,000 pediatric patients per year, and it is the second leading cause of death in children age 1 through 14. Accidents lead. Mortality has improved dramatically over the last 3 to 4 decades due to improvements in our treatments. And so that's the about childhood cancer. Let's move on to specific diseases. This is medulloblastoma. This is perhaps the most important in terms of bread and butter and common brain tumors that we see and treat. This is the second most common pediatric brain tumor, but the most common malignant tumor, and there's over 400 pediatric patients per year affected in the United States. This is a tumor that can seed the cerebral spinal fluid and therefore necessitates CSI as part of its treatment. The median age for these kids is about 7 years of age, and patients are typically staged with something called Chang staging, and there should not be an E on that Chang. And here it is. M0 disease is no evidence of metastasis. M1 is microscopic cells in the CSF. M2 is brain metastasis, and M3 is spine metastasis. M4 is metastasis outside the central nervous system, and typically bone is its favorite place to go if it's going to go outside. Workup includes brain MRI and spine MRI, ideally preoperatively if possible. CSF cytology needs to be obtained 10 to 14 days after surgery. It's usually not safe to obtain before surgery due to the hydrocephalus these kids often present with. Once you get baseline labs, and include endocrine labs for that, also get a baseline audiology and neurocognitive test, preferably within 6 months of starting therapy, but it's one of those things that it doesn't change quickly, so it is not a hurry to get done right away. There's really three groups of medullo, four if you're very nuanced. Basically, we've got standard risk group, the high risk group, the infant medullo population, and then you know, for the nuanced provider, I think there's an intermediate risk population as well. Let's talk about treatment for standard risk and high risk, because that's the most common and sort of the basis for what we do. Children with standard risk disease have no evidence of metastasis and have had either a gross total resection or less than 1.5 centimeters squared of residual disease in the primary site. Also, the histology needs to be classic or desmoplastic. Large cell or anaplastic variants get sort of pushed into a different category. The standard therapy for these patients is 23.4 grays, craniospinal radiation followed by a boost really to the tumor bed to 54 gray, not so much the whole posterior fossa anymore. And then this is followed by chemotherapy, which is cisplatinum based. 5-year event-free survival is about 81%, overall survival about 86%, and high-risk disease is managed similarly but a little bit differently and more intensively. So these are patients with metastatic disease at diagnosis, usually, or have greater than 1.5 centimeters squared of residual in the primary site, although that's an area of some controversy. The standard therapy for these patients is 36 gray with either a whole posterior fossa or a tumor bed boost. Tumor bed is also known as involved field, that's what the IF stands for, to 54 gray, usually with concurrent chemotherapy, either weekly vincristine and or daily carboplatin. And this is then followed with adjuvant cisplatin chemotherapy, usually 6 cycles if you're following the COG protocol, but there's a St. Jude regimen of 4 cycles that's fairly intense as well. And median survival, 5-year event-free survival is around 60 to 70%. It's actually worse in some other studies, but I like to present the best data out there. Now, I talked about this intermediate risk category that's not really widely accepted, but I think it's helpful because it happens a fair amount. We have, these are patients that have a gross total resected tumor that's either anaplastic or large cell variant, but otherwise non-metastatic. So they would meet criteria for standard risk except for the histology. And they do kind of in between the standard risk patients and the high risk patients. And so I like to call them intermediate risk. The COG protocol that sort of stratifies patients into categories by both biology, which I'll discuss briefly, also uses the term intermediate risk. And it's something I've adopted as well, but it's not quite as widespread in the community. Now let's talk about infant medulloblastoma because this is really a different beast. Sometimes this is clumped with high risk, but it's just you can't treat them the same way. So I think it's more helpful to think of infant medullo as its own category. Now, radiation really has an adverse effect on kids from a neurocognitive perspective, and it's most profound in the very young children under the age of 3. It's devastating to them. So we cannot use craniospinal radiation in this patient population. And so we usually instead use high-dose chemotherapy, plus or minus, either involve field radiation for some patients, although the use of radiation overall is controversial. Now, cure rates suffer due to 2 things, basically a lack of radiation employment and the biology of the disease. So for the most part, infants actually have a worse biology, with a 1 exception of the subgroup that has desmoplastic histology, and then they actually do quite well with just chemotherapy alone. But outside of that group, an M0 medulloblastoma in the infant population treated with chemotherapy alone, cure rates are close to 50%. So we're starting to learn a lot more about the biology of different medulloblastomas, and there's now 4 different molecular subgroups: the Wnt pathway group, the Sonic Hedgehog group, groups 3 and groups 4. We can go into great detail, but I like to have it simplified just into these groups because that's clinically really what we use. The Wnt pathway has the best prognosis. Sonic Hedgehog, not bad, it's pretty good. Group 3 and group 4, not as good, but group 3 is sort of the worst of them. And they're more likely to have MYC amplification, which is kind of a bad prognostic factor. It's not game over, but it makes you worry more. Now let's talk about the recently closed and soon to be published Children's Oncology Group 0331, which was an average risk medulloblastoma study. This was interesting because it was a radiation double randomization. So in the kids under the age of 8, we randomized the craniospinal dose to either 23.4 gray versus 18 gray. And then there was a second randomization to either a whole posterior fossa boost or involve field boost. But here's what we found, that there was a 10% decrement in disease-free survival in the 18 gray group, unfortunately. Now, with regards to the tumor bed boost or involved field versus whole posterior fossa, there was absolutely no difference in disease control, and therefore we use the tumor bed boost. Next, let's talk about the guidelines for developing the involved field boost. I'm really going to let you read most of this, but I'm going to highlight a couple things. I use both the preoperative and the postoperative imaging, and the images I use most commonly are the axial T1 postcads in addition to the T2 images. And I find the T2 images actually really helpful because very occasionally you do get a tumor that actually invades into the brain, and this is sorted out well with those. I define my gross target volume, making sure I cover all the surfaces that the original tumor covered, but carve out the cerebellar regions that come back into the field or come back into where the primary tumor was once it was resected. And then I expand on the order of about 8 to 10 millimeters around it. I don't use the full COG 1.5 centimeter margin, but it really depends on how you draw your CTV, how big the patient is, that sort of thing. But for the most part, I end up using a little bit more constrained CTV coverage margins. And then your PTV is usually about 3 millimeters in the head or less if you have cone beam and you're quite confident with it. So histology, as I mentioned before, is really important. The anaplastic or large cell tumors, which are grouped together, really don't do as well as the non-anaplastic or classic histology, classic slash desmoplastic. And so this is true in both the standard risk and the high risk populations. And in medulloblastoma, this is just the data for the standard risk population. There's basically, if you have intermediate risk disease, which again is the standard risk population with anaplasia, then your event-free survival goes from 83% to 73%. And so this finding in Roger Packer's important study published in 2006 basically ended up knocking the kids with anaplasia off the standard risk study that I already presented to you, ACNS-0331. And then because we didn't have a place to put these patients, the high-risk study then allowed enrollment of these otherwise standard-risk patients with just this one variant of anaplasia. So now the high-risk protocol has been renamed other than average risk, although everyone just calls it the high-risk protocol because other than average risk is just too hard to say. So the high-risk protocol is basically a randomization between whether patients get concurrent weekly vincristine versus concurrent weekly vincristine with daily carboplatin. And then there's another randomization with adjuvant chemotherapy versus adjuvant chemotherapy plus isotretinoin, which is a differentiating agent. The isotretinoin arms closed early because a futility analysis shows that there would be no benefit. This study has been recently closed, and we're awaiting results. But what I highlighted in the previous slide, and I can't go back when I'm taping, is that it had some pilot study data that was quite good, and I've hidden those slides, but you can read more about that as we go. Now, how do we incorporate molecular subgrouping into treatment? So for risk stratification and new diagnoses, we use it really in the Wnt pathway groups in COG. So if the patient has a Wnt pathway tumor and standard risk, they get a lower dose of CSI of 18 gray. This is open and accruing. St. Jude also has a study that I think is still open and accruing, but it's scheduled to close soon, where the CSI doses in the Wnt pathway group is decreased to 15 gray craniospinal radiation. And they have other sort of details in their study where the sonic hedgehog group gets a sonic hedgehog inhibitor if they are skeletally mature, and that's because they found that the sonic hedgehog inhibitors have been prematurely closing growth plates in patients. And then the groups 3 and 4 get a combination chemo of pemetrexed and gemcitabine. Now we also use grouping for recurrent disease. So the sonic hedgehog patients will get a sonic hedgehog inhibitor, vismodegib or sonidegib. Unfortunately, although we see an early and usually good response in those, usually the tumors break through and the patient comes back with recurrent disease after that. Now, during treatment, it's important to not give a treatment break to your medulloblastoma patients if at all possible. Now, you monitor your CBCs weekly for sure. Your ANCs typically do drop, and your platelets often drop as well. But as long as the patient's not sick, you either push through it. If it's getting dangerously low, you want to switch to the posterior fossa boost or the involved field boost, and then go back to the CSI once their counts have had a chance to recover. But overall, you really want to avoid treatment breaks. because this impairs overall disease control. And ideally, keeping the overall treatment time less than 45 days is optimal. There's some more slides on this that are hidden that give you more details. Follow-up studies. So basically, you want to be sure to follow patients with history and physical, with MRI, brain and spine, at least yearly with the spine when they're first out of treatment. You want to follow them more often than yearly, sort of listed there. But you also need to follow these patients with audiograms, neurocognitive evaluations, and endocrine evaluations. Their endocrine and audiograms can be done yearly, but the neurocognitive evaluation should be done probably every 2 to 3 years instead of 1 to 2, as these kids are affected, and it can actually really help improve their academic performance because they get special accommodations in school that really augment their learning and ability to achieve. So these kids have the highest rates of cerebellar posterior fossa mutism syndrome after surgery, and the rates are anywhere from 25 to 40%. Now, this is a syndrome that's characterized by diminished speech, emotional ability, hypotonia, ataxia, and cranial nerve deficits. I have more slides on this that are hidden for you to read up a little bit more if you're interested. You can go ahead and treat through the posterior fossa syndrome. It just complicates things for you because due to the emotional ability and that sort of thing, you're typically going to have to use anesthesia at a younger age in these kids that are affected, at least with the moderate or severe forms. Let's move on to ependymoma. This is the third most common tumor in children and that we see and treat in radiation oncology. There's over 250 patients in the United States that are affected every year. And this is a disease of really young kids with median age of presentation around 4 years. It can occur anywhere in the CNS. However, the most common is in the posterior fossa, where 60% of the tumors arise. And then 30% arise in the supratentorial space. We have about 10% arising in the spinal cord, and these are usually mixopapillary ependymomas, although you can get the classic and anaplastic histologies there as well. I'm going to focus on the brain tumor parts of the treatment because they're really what we see the most. This is a picture of the histology of the three different types of ependymoma. Workup is not dissimilar to the medulloblastomas in that these tumors have the ability to spread throughout the craniospinal axis, and so you do need a workup of the spine with an MRI as well as an LP for cytology, again preferably 10 days or more from surgery, and a postoperative MRI to evaluate the resection within 48 hours. Now, there's a few prognostic factors that are super important. The extent of resection is by far the most important prognostic factor. Tumor grade is also important, so anaplasia versus classic, the anaplastic patients do worse. And then the molecular features are starting to sort them out. This is still an evolving story, but what is really shaking out as most important is 1Q gain in the posterior fossa tumors. When possible, get a gross total resection, and this does need to be followed with radiotherapy. Certainly in the supratentorial setting, if it's anaplastic, you can potentially follow those patients if it's classic, but I'll talk a little bit more about that. This is an area of controversy. But with regards to the posterior fossa, you always need radiation grade 2 or grade 3. The dose is between 54 and 59.4, which means you are in trouble with the brainstem, so you do need to use some really creative techniques. Typically in the patients with a gross total resection, we stop at 54 gray using protons. Some people still push to 59-40, but I think the higher you push, the higher the rates and risk of brainstem necrosis. So there's this whole discussion in the literature right now about protons and photons and whether modality affects that. The short answer is it's controversial, but I do think it's true. It does affect it, and you have to be more careful with protons, but quite frankly, we should be careful with both our proton and our photon technologies. So if you're going to know a study, this is the study to know. This is the COG-ACNS-0121 publication that just came out in JCO in 2019. This is where we took the pediatric penemoma patients, and there's four different stratas. There's basically 356 patients in the study with 8 years of follow-up. So this is really a good study for long-term follow-up. These are the strata, and the overall event-free survival for all comers in the study was 63%. Now, let's break it down by arm. So the five-year event-free survival for this cohort, for the observation arm, which is the supratentorial patients with a gross total resection, grade 2, was 61%. Now, depending on your viewpoint, this is controversial. Some say, see, you need radiation. Others say, see, you can get away without radiation. So I think it's sort of a discussion that I have with the family. About follow-up and what their risk tolerance is for recurrence. Now, for the patients who've had a subtotal resection, they do the least well with 37% event-free survival at 5 years, and the patients with a near total or gross total resection have close to a 70% five-year event-free survival. Now, anaplasia really matters. So the five-year event-free survival in the patients with a gross total resection with anaplastic tumors is only 61% compared to 75% with grade 2 or classic histologies. Now, the only biologic factor that really weighed out or worked out to be important was the gain of 1Q in the posterior fossa tumors. If you had it, it connoted a worse prognosis. Interestingly, RELA-fusion versus YAP in the supratentorial tumors and posterior fossa A versus posterior fossa B type biology breakdown did not alter the event-free survival, surprisingly, although in prior to this study, those were shaking out as important in retrospective series. This just highlights the importance of prospective series and sort of testing things. So, it's an evolving story. But to conclude, observation is still controversial, and it depends on how you view the outcomes. It is being studied in the current COG, a penemoma study again, to see if we can get more patients and better delineate whether or not this is a good strategy for these patients. Right now, postoperative radiation for all posterior fossa tumors and supratentorial anaplastic or any anaplastic tumor remains the standard. And then the goal is really a gross total resection. This is the current COG study that just closed to accrual in May of 2019. This was a study that randomized patients to adjuvant chemotherapy after the radiotherapy. And below are the radiation guidelines that they recommend. Let's move on to germ cell tumors. These are relatively rare. We have 2% of pediatric CNS tumors in the United States, but in some parts of the world, it's as high as 9% of pediatric brain tumors. There is some controversy over the numbers. Germinomas make up 2/3 of this, whereas non-germinomas, germ cell tumors, make up the remainder, and they are comprised by a variety of different histologies, embryonal carcinomas, endodermal sinus tumors, choriocarcinomas, teratomas, etc. These tumors usually occur in the pineal region or the supercellar region, but can uncommonly also arise in the basal ganglia or thalami. Markers can help with a diagnosis. Surgery is safer now and, quite frankly, worthwhile to pursue and to make a truly proper diagnosis, because markers can leave you with a little bit of unclarity of what you're dealing with. So AFP always indicates a non-germinomatous germ cell tumors tumor, whereas germinomas can have a mild elevation in beta-HCG, but it's usually negative. Choriocarcinomas associated with very high beta-HCG, and yolk sac tumors typically have a high AFP, but a mature teratoma can also have a mild elevation of AFP as well. So it's not always clear, and I advocate when your surgeon is comfortable in doing so, that at least getting some kind of tissue sampling or resection is really helpful. The hazard of tissue sampling is that there can be a sampling error and that you may not get all parts of the tumor. Now, With regards to presentation, the pineal region has a slight predilection for boys and usually presents with elevated intracranial pressure as well as paranoid syndrome. Supercellular germ cell tumors have a slight predilection for girls, which usually present with hormonal deficiencies or abnormalities, including precocious puberty, but also visual impairments an issue. Typically, we also see some growth hormone impairment as well. So let's talk about treatment for germinomas first. There's two options that are both very reasonable. One includes chemotherapy and one does not. But the minimum radiation field size that you need to know about is the whole ventricle for germinomas. You always have a whole ventricle field and then a boost to the, you have a whole ventricle field in the M0 patients and then a boost to the primary region. So if you're using chemotherapy, it's usually carboplatin etoposide, 3 to 4 cycles. And we typically use this in the younger patients where we give them whole ventricle radiation and involved field boost. And then the whole vent dose can be anywhere from 18 to 24 gray with a boost of 30 to 36. And we go at 1.5 gray per fraction. Older patients that have M0 disease can get away without chemotherapy, and then we bring the whole ventricle dose up to 25 gray and involve field juice boost to 45 to 50 gray. We typically have the older teenagers that choose this option because when presented with about a 6-month course of treatment versus a 6-week course of treatment, not surprisingly, they like the 6-week one better. And I think that's honestly fine in the older age group. That difference in radiation dose probably doesn't make much of a difference in the neurocognitive outcomes. Now, when patients have disseminated disease, you can also treat with radiation alone with CSI and then a boost to 45 gray to the primary site at 1.5 gray per fraction. But we typically like to reach for the chemotherapy approach where we give, again, carboplatin etoposide and then CSI somewhere around 21 gray with a boost to the primary disease to 30 to 36. And if they have less than a perfect response, then I err on the side of the higher dose for each of the ranges that I've given there. Now, important to realize in germinomas is that you can have multiple midline germinomas where both supercellular and the pineal region need boosting, but you can also have an occult multifocal disease. So if you have a patient who has a pineal lesion that is visible, but also has problems with their hypothalamic pituitary axis, then they are presumptively positive multiple midline tumor situation, and you also need to boost the primary you also need to boost the supercellular region in addition to the pineal region. This is a really elegant study that was conducted by Claire Alapetit, where they looked at the relapses of patients treated with chemotherapy alone and involved field radiotherapy. And this is the reason why we treat whole ventricles. It was in fashion and in vogue for a while there to use chemotherapy and then just involve field alone. But we found out that doesn't actually work. So we now use whole ventricle field as the smallest field in germinomas that are localized at presentation. So germ cell tumors, this is the radiation technique. Whole ventricles are basically drawn on the CT, which is augmented if you use the T2 fusion MRIs because it lights up the ventricles better. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail about this due to time, but if you Google the whole ventricle atlas for pictorial help, this is really useful. There's a question about whether you want to include the prepontine cistern. We always include it if there's been a third ventriculostomy, and honestly, since I deal with protons, even when there's not been a third ventriculostomy, I cover this region as well, but it is an area of some controversy, or at least a divergence of opinion. This is just what your whole ventricle field may look like using protons versus IMRT. And let's talk about non-germinomas germ cell treatment. The The recent study that's actually still open for germinoma, but arm is closed for the non-germinomous germ cell tumor arm. And this was a study that evaluated if we could get away from craniospinal radiation in the non-germinomous germ cell tumors and use just whole ventricle field instead, hoping to improve neurocognitive outcomes. Unfortunately, this was closed because we met stopping criteria after an increased number of spinal failures occurred. So the bottom line is, for the non-germinomatous germ cell tumor treatments, you still need to treat with craniospinal radiation followed by a boost to the primary site. So the board's answer for dose, for CSI dose, is 36 gray officially, either for the M0 or M positive patients. But I have to say, in our institution, we've used a lesser dose for the CSI, anywhere from 27 to 36 gray, especially in the younger kids with no evidence of metastasis at diagnosis. And so far, we've gotten away with that. So this is just some details about the ACNS-1123 germinoma arm. I will leave you to read this on your own. The non-germinomatous germ cell tumors. Let's talk about that. If you know one study, this is the study to know. This is by Stu Goldman and team that was published in JCO in 2015. This is a study of 100 patients, and they defined their patient population as those patients with beta HCGs greater than 50 or any other non-germinomatous germ cell tumor. They acknowledged in their paper that this may include some high-risk germinomas, but I think initially they set out really trying to just get at the non-germinomatous germ cell tumor population. But basically, this is a study of induction chemotherapy, 6 cycles, carboplatin etoposide alternating with ifosfamide etoposide, followed by radiation at 36 gray and a boost to 54 gray. The outcome is this: at median follow-up of 5 years, 84% had a 5-year event-free survival. Sorry, the 5-year event-free survival was 84%. What they did note, importantly, is that the AFP elevation was very high. And what I realized I haven't told you is, compared to the germinomas, non-germinomas germ cell tumors had a worse prognosis. Germinomas are cured about 90% of the time, even in the setting of dissemination. Non-germinomas germ cell tumors, 84% 5-year event-free survival is the best we've seen so far. But what I think is going on in this study is that because they defined the inclusion criteria as markers only was sufficient, and if a beta HCG was over 50, then they were included. And I think what happened is that we ended up including a lot of germinomas in this study that were perhaps overtreated, and that's why we have such a high 5-year event-free survival. The COG study that recently closed defined a beta HCG of over 100 for inclusion criteria, so they're probably parsing out at least some of the germinomas. But you can still have a germinoma that's a syncytial trophoblastic variant that's over 100 beta HCG. So that's why I prefer to have a biopsy, is really know what we're working with. This is just the data from the Stu Goldman study of non-germinomatous germ cell tumors, which showed the AFP over 10 as a bad prognostic factor. The bottom line is, we do need to treat the non-germinomatous germ cell tumors with 36 gray CSI. AFP is a worse actor, and we should probably use biopsies and know better what we're dealing with in order to better appropriately treat our patients. Let's talk about low-grade gliomas. This is the most common pediatric tumor, comprising 40% of the pediatric brain tumors, and there are 900 cases per year in the United States. We, as radiation oncologists, typically see the ones in the midline region, or the ones that are not resectable. There's two major grades: the Hu grade 1, Hu grade 2, different histologies in each, but for the most part, the Hu grade 1 pilocytic astrocytomas are the most common. Treatment depends on age when resectable. So in general, resect it. If it's not resectable, We tend to watch them. Sometimes we watch them even when they're resectable just to make sure they're actually tumors. But surveillance is a viable treatment option for these because they are often quite indolent. And patients with NF1, often these tumors just don't progress once they reach adulthood. So you can even watch a low-grade glioma NF1 patient safely. A lot of times you can't, but sometimes you can. Now, if the patient is less than 10, doesn't have NF1, you can also start with chemotherapy, usually prior to radiation, just due to the age factor and the risk of neurocognitive consequences of the radiation. The first line agents are usually vincristine carboplatin, although there's a lot of agents that are effective, and on average, it delays radiation for about 3 years. But other agents can be used. Second line chemotherapy has been vinblastine, vinorelbine, that sort of thing. Now, when the tumor progresses or there's neurologic symptoms that we really want to stop, we often, or when the patient's old enough, then we use radiation and it's usually curative. Control rates are about 70% at 10 years, and the St. Jude study is actually a very good study to read if you want to read up on low-grade gliomas. This is the radiation technique we use. Again, we use a CT scan and the fusion MRIs, usually the T2 sequences, as well as the T1 post-gadolinium, and include about a 5 mm margin around the tumor that we can see that's anatomically constrained. Dose to these lesions are about 50 to 54 grays. Importantly, these low-grade tumors that don't enhance or are heterogeneously enhancing, the parts of the tumor that don't enhance can enhance after radiation, and this can look like tumor progression. And here's a couple of references that show that. And this is just a picture of pseudoprogression in a low-grade glioma patient. I know we talk about this a lot in the adult setting, but we don't talk about it that often in the pediatric setting. But it's there, and you should be aware of it. Let's change gears and talk about high-grade gliomas. This is 12% of pediatric brain tumors. They occur in different parts of the brain. There's basically grade 3 anaplastic astrocytomas and grade 4 glioblastomas. Median age at diagnosis is 10 years. The prognosis overall is actually poor for these patients, with a median survival of 1 to 2 years, but infants do better, and it's probably due to different biology of disease. I am not going into biology, but I put a bunch of biology slides in the online version. Now, the 3-year event-free survival for anaplastic astrocytoma and glioblastoma is about 13% and 17%, which is kind of grim. This is sort of worse than what we thought we used to do, but it turns out in the 80s and 90s, we were misdiagnosing a portion of our patients that had pilocytic astrocytomas and calling them glioblastoma, and that's why our rates of cure seem to have gone down over the years. It's really not. It's just a factor of better classification. Prognostic factors in high-grade glioma include extent of resection, greater than 90%, but really a gross total resection is the best if you can achieve it. Grade 3 versus 4, 3 does better. Site, central is bad, lateralized is good. And then there's some biologic factors that also play a role. Histone gene mutation, H3.3 K27M, is shaking out as a very nasty indicator of biology, and typically involving the central tumors, including those that are DIPGs. Treatment includes really surgery and radiation for sure, and radiation dose is similar to the adults, which is 54 to 60 gray. The use of chemotherapy is a little bit more controversial. We tend to use it in the pediatric population. I think there's one study that does sort of give us hope that it's helpful, and that is the study that's published by Reggie Jakacki. And here's sort of the summary. This is a COG study that looked at temozolomide concurrently with radiation, and then adjuvantly, temozolomide was given with CCNU for 6 cycles out back. And then the 3-year event-free survival was 22% versus 11%, which is better than we had done before. And so this is the regimen we're typically reaching for, although there's plenty of open studies now evaluating other biologic agents, because clearly this is not a home run either. These are the radiation guidelines for high-grade glioma, just to be aware of. You can go on over these at your leisure. And this is a patient I treated. I like to use this as an example. So I treated a 1.5-year-old with glioblastoma who had a gross total resection, flew across the country to see us, and then recurred during that time that he was traveling for radiation. We re-resected the lesion and again post-op radiation. And he did well. He's now NED for 10 years. His neurocognitive outcome is surprisingly good. We used protons, so we kept a lot of the high dose to the ipsilateral brain, and I think the neuroplasticity in the young patients is actually helping with his neurocognitive outcomes. So that's a happy story and an indicator that the young patients do better, and it's biologically driven. Let's talk about diffuse intrinsic pontine glioma very quickly. This is a terrible tumor. It's a tumor that expands the pons. It typically is a radiographic diagnosis, and patients typically present with a very short interval of symptoms, including diplopia, motor weakness, sometimes difficulty with speech. Cranial nerve abnormalities are common. Unfortunately, the median time to death is 8 to 12 months, and that has stubbornly not budged despite trying to enroll all of these patients in the last 3 decades on trials assessing various different chemotherapies, hyperfractionation, radiosensitizers, there's all sorts of things. The good news is radiation does give good relief of symptoms and relatively quickly. We typically now treat with 54 gray at 1.8 gray per fraction, not with chemotherapy because it hasn't shown to be helpful when they're off protocol, but there are protocols out there that are trying to incorporate biologic agents. A few of these patients have EGFR receptors, so some of them will respond to those as well. Now we're biopsying these tumors because we're trying to biologically drive better treatment strategies, but a biopsy is not needed for diagnosis. Craniopharyngioma is a common tumor you also see in the adult population. There's over 200 patients per year. In pediatrics, we only see the adamantinomatous type. And I just want to highlight that these tumors are not benign, despite the calling them benign. They appear well marginated, but can be very sticky, and surgery can be very difficult. They can stick to important structures like optics and the hypothalamus and the third ventricle. And we are now moving towards a more conservative surgical approach to decompress cysts, and then followed with radiation. And that seems to be equally as efficacious as dramatic surgery. So this is a picture of the craniopharyngioma that can be in the third ventricle that's attaching to the third ventricular wall. And in this case, it was resected, but it also took a little part of the brain with it, which is one of the reasons why the postoperative complications for these patients can be devastating and include hyperphagia disorder, sleep disorders, all sorts of things that the hypothalamus seems to control. So this is a patient that had a resection, and the radiation tumor bed, because it can leave little rests of tumor anywhere that the tumor touched, we always cover the whole extent of where the tumor was when treating. And usually local control is on the order of between 80 and 95%, depending on what study you read. Let's talk about rhabdomyosarcoma and shift into the non-CNS tumors. Rhabdo has about 400 cases per year annually and comprises about 3 to 4% of childhood cancers. Peak incidence is in young kids between 2 and 5 years of age and can occur anywhere in the body, but the most common sites are in the head and neck, the georegions, and the extremities. This is a tumor type that is commonly associated with genetic syndromes, including Li-Fraumeni, Beckwith-Wiedemann, NF, Noonan, and Costello. The pathology is really evolving to be biologically driven, but the biology sort of mirrors imperfectly, but does mirror the histologic subtypes. So there are two major histologic subtypes, the embryonal rhabdos and then the alveolar. The embryonal rhabdos are typically fusion negative, which means they have no FOXO1 translocation that is typically seen in the alveolar population. And the alveolar patients or the FOXO1 translocated or translocation positive patients typically do a bit worse than the embryonal patients. This is a little bit more detail about the specific translocations and the details behind that, but I think we'll skip over that for now. Basically, the problem with rhabdo is that it's complicated and it doesn't necessarily make sense. So you just have to memorize some things. So you have to memorize basically the favorable sites and the unfavorable sites because this underpins the staging. Favorable sites includes head and neck, non-parameningeal, orbit, GU, non-bladder prostate, biliary tract. The unfavorable sites are the parameningeals, which is the most common tumor type we as radiation oncologists see, comprising about 50% of the rhabdos that we see, then bladder, prostate, extremities, and then trunk retroperitoneum. So workup includes history physical, CT, and MRI of the primary site. Clearly, you need a biopsy to know what the tumor biology is and the diagnosis is, fusion status. You also need a chest CT. It likes to go to the lungs. We also typically get abdominal CT with it. Bone marrow biopsy is critical, and either a bone scan or a PET scan. I personally prefer a PET scan because you can also see lymph nodes that were perhaps not otherwise picked up. Now, if it's a parameningeal rhabdo, you also need to get CSF cytology and a brain MRI. So there's, with rhabdo, you have your sites that are favorable and unfavorable. You have your clinical groups, you have your staging, and you have your risk stratification. This is why this is not a favorite of a lot of residents. It's so complicated. But this is the clinical grouping, which is based on their surgical stage at the time of starting chemotherapy. It looks horrific, but you don't have to know all the A's, B's, and C's, so you can simplify it and really go to this. So basically, group one is a gross total resection, margins negative. Group two is a gross total resection, margins positive, microscopically. Group three is gross residual disease seen on MRI or CT scan, or noted by the surgeon. And then group four is metastasis. Staging, likewise, looks horrifying, but at the same time, it's really not. It can be simplified once you understand the favorable and unfavorable sites and what big means or node positive. So basically, a tumor is big if it's greater than 5 centimeters. And so basically, it can be broken down into these four stages. Stage one is favorable. Sites, any size, any nodal status. So unfavorable is stage two, but it has to be small and node negative. Stage three is unfavorable, and it can be large, a tumor, meaning greater than 5 centimeters, or node positive, or both. And then four is distant mets. There's risk stratification. There's low risk, intermediate, and high risk, and here the risk stratification is here. One highlight is that a recent change by COG is that now incorporated into the intermediate risks, and this was also done about 15 years ago, was that the kids with metastatic disease under the age of 10 with embryonal tumors or FOXO1 negative translocated tumors are considered intermediate risk because we're actually pretty good at curing those patients. Otherwise, high-risk patients are metastatic patients. Low-risk patients are typically either the unresected favorable sites and favorable histology, meaning embryonal, or resected unfavorable sites. These are the dose guidelines. You kind of need to just memorize this and read it. I want to highlight the orbital dose used to be standardly 45 gray. It's now moving back up to 50.4 and sort of response-based. If there's a partial response, I'm typically using about 48.8 as my standard dose. Sorry, 48.6 is my standard dose. So radiation timing, basically just remember week 12. And for low and intermediate risk patients, we bring in the radiation at week 12 after starting chemotherapy. For the high risk patients, we either bring it in to the primary site at week 12 or week 20, depending on the protocol you're following, but either is appropriate. Now, for the high-risk patients, we often treat the various different sites of metastasis, but we usually wait until the very end to allow better bone marrow tolerance. So if a patient has lung mets, for example, and they have a parameningeal rhabdo, we might treat them at week 20 to the primary site for the parameningeal rhabdo, or week 12, I should say, either way. And then at the end of all the chemotherapy, which is usually like week 50 or something, we bring in the radiation to the whole lung, and that's because it's a very marrow suppressive. This is the intermediate risk rhabdo study that is currently accruing. This has a VAC-VI backbone of chemotherapy, and the VAC part, the A, stands for actinomycin, which is really important, and you leave the actinomycin out when you're treating with radiation because it doesn't play well with radiation. Temsirolimus is being tested because it was very effective in the recurrent setting. And this is a study that's open and accruing, so I'd encourage you to accrue if you can. These are the guidelines for treatment. I will leave you to read this on your own. And this is a discussion quickly of prognosis. Basically, the orbital tumors really should have a better than 90% disease-free survival. It's really local failures where they tend to fail. In the past two COG studies, we've backed off on the radiation dose while concurrently backing off on the cyclophosphamide dose. So we went from 50 gray to 45 gray for orbits, and then we've also backed off on the cyclophosphamide dose, and it turns out we had an increase in local failure. So the chemo has stayed the same with a low dose of cyclophosphamide, but we're now using higher radiation doses in the orbits, even though there's no COG to set that standard. There's a really good study by Ralph Vermoyen that discusses this that I didn't cite there, but Ralph Vermoyen has a nice paper on this. Intermediate risk, we cure about 70% of patients for the most part. High risk, we actually cure about 30%. So those are pretty reasonable numbers. Let's talk more about local control because we're radiation oncologists. Basically, two studies ago in D9803, we had a local failure rate of 19% in this patient population. And we found that there was an increased risk of local failure in patients that had tumors over 5 centimeters. So the differential was 25% local failure versus 10%. And this is why on the current study, we escalate the dose to 59 gray for tumors that are greater than 5 centimeters. But wait, just sort of on the red down below, it gets worse. On the one study ago, AST0531, there's a recent local control study that shows worse local control, and this had a decreased cyclophosphamide dose. We may be backsliding and still discovering. So this is the study I was just talking about. Our a 5-year local failure rate in the group 3 embryonal rhabdomyosarcomas right here is actually worse than it was on D9803, which I just presented. So it's 27% versus 19%. And we think that is because there is a decreased intensity of cyclophosphamide, so similar to the orbital rhabdo study. And then also in this paper, which was not appreciated, in the Hawkins paper and JCO for the primary outcome for event-free survival, but event-free survival and overall survival was actually worse on AST0531 compared to D9803, and they think it's due to the lower cyclophosphamide dosing. It was statistically significant. Interestingly, they don't give you the rates of event-free survival. They only give you a hazard ratio in the paper, which is why I didn't give you the rate. So just to let you know, the recurrent rhabdos, it looks like temsirolimus is a good agent, and combined with vinorelbine and cyclophosphamide, it was statistically significantly better than bevacizumab in the same combination, and that's why it's now moved into the upfront setting in the intermediate risk study. Let's shift gears and go to Ewing sarcoma, and we'll fly through it quickly because I'm really running out of time. So this is the second most common bone tumor of childhood, although this can also occur in soft tissue, and it comprises 3% of all pediatric malignancies. It's most common in the teenagers, but can occur in the kids under 10, and it's actually a better prognostic factor the younger you are. It's more common in the extremities than in the axial skeleton, but again, a little bit like rhabdo, site matters. So the pelvis is kind of the worst site, but axial location's also bad. Other negative prognostic factors include metastasis, large tumor size, older age at diagnosis, poor response to induction chemo, and an elevated LDH. This is the pathology. We typically diagnose this by looking for translocations, and there are typically two. There's one more common than the other. History and physical are critical in the workup. We also need a CT and MRI of the primary site, and these also like to metastasize to lungs and bone. So having either a PET or bone scan and then a chest CT are critical, as well as bone marrow biopsy. Now, multi-agent chemotherapy comprises the backbone of the treatment. The standard chemotherapy is VAC-IE, and in this case, in the VAC, it's Adriamycin, not Actinomycin. And again, like the other VAC, when you're giving radiotherapy to the patient, you drop out the Adriamycin because this just makes all the side effects worse. There's a controversy in certain circumstances of whether you should use surgery versus radiation. My take on it is in the era where we're now using sufficient cyclophosphamide and ifosfamide dosing, the data does not necessarily support using a surgery over radiotherapy. In a lot of situations, radiotherapy is less toxic, so it's still chosen. But if you look at all the literature, which includes patients back to an era where we didn't add the ifosfamide etoposide, you will see a slight benefit for surgery. Surgery is still important to use if you can resect it without a lot of morbidity because there's an increased second malignancy risk in this population. So that's my preference when it can be used, but when it will devastate a kid from a morbidity standpoint, I do not recommend it. The current COG study is a study that is looking at or looked at VAC-IE versus basically VAC-IE with topotecan involved. And basically what they found is that there's no difference in event-free survival. And so the basic chemotherapy backbone is still VAC-IE, with the IE being ifosfamide. These are the radiation guidelines. And let's talk briefly about Wilms' tumor. I have 3 minutes left. This is 6% of all childhood cancer, 500 cases per year, median age is 3.5 years. And this is a tumor that's also associated with congenital anomalies. I'm going to skip this in the interest of time. This is the staging. Pretty much stage three and four are the stages you as a radiation oncologist will treat. There are multiple syndromes associated with Wilms as well. And with regards to pathology and genetics, what's important for you to know is there's favorable histology Wilms, which comprises 85% of the kidney tumors that you see, and then you have unfavorable histologies, which include Wilms with diffuse aneuplasia or focal, clear cell sarcoma, rhabdoid, and renal cells. There's also two genes associated with Wilms, WT1. WT2 is associated with Beckwith-Wiedemann syndrome. Other biologic indicators include LOH of 1P and 16Q, connotes a worse prognosis, as well as gain of 1Q. There's a risk stratification scheme that's pretty dizzying. Standard and high risk are typically what you as radiation oncologists will see. This is helpful background, but we don't have time to go over the details. And this is the radiation guidelines. Basically, for flank radiation for favorable histology Wilms, it stops at 10.8 gray, so very low dose. Lung radiation typically goes to 12 gray in the kids over 1 year of age and stays at 10 in the kids under 1 year of age. There's a whole controversy about whether lung radiation is needed up front, and that's discussed well in a JCO paper cited there by Dix. My bias is if they need it, you should probably give it up front because from a dosimetric perspective, this is better. Here are the radiation guidelines for Wilms tumor. And then this is the details for the dosing for high-risk renal tumors, and then what to do in the setting of a bilateral Wilms tumor. Let's briefly talk about neuroblastoma. I'm 4 seconds left. But we have 650 cases per year. This is most common extracranial solid tumor. It behaves in a variety of ways, from spontaneous regression to aggressive metastatic disease. And I've hidden a lot of slides on this, so please go back to the handout. Largely for biology, if you're young, 1.5 years old or less, have low stage or 4S disease, that's all good. Basically, it's the high risk patients, however, that we see and treat that are critical for radiation oncologists. Most common presentation is in the abdomen, arising from the adrenal gland, but it can actually arise anywhere in the sympathetic chain. This is the history and physical. These tumors usually do metastasize. Bone marrow biopsy is absolutely critical. MIBG scan is super helpful. This is the staging that we have used for many years that has recently changed. It's still important to know about it because this is how we functioned for basically all but the last 3 or 4 years, and all the data is presented according to the staging. Most important are, again, stage 3 and stage 4, which is typically what we see. The new staging is this, where L stands for localized and M stands for metastasis. And it's usually L2 and M that we are dealing with in the high-risk patients. So definition of high-risk, basically MYC, N amplification, and high stage, and age over 1.5, although there's some details here that you'll want to read. The overall treatment approach for these high-risk medulloblastoma patients starts with induction chemotherapy, 5 cycles, surgery of the primary tumor, the high-dose chemotherapy and stem cell rescue, x2, and this is important, tandem transplants are now recommended, and then this is followed with radiation, and after radiation, we give immunotherapy and isotretinoin, which is a differentiating agent that works well in neuroblastoma but failed miserably in medulloblastoma. This is a study, if you're going to know one, it's actually a good one to know and read, that argues for the benefit of tandem transplant over single transplant. They also found that patients that had a poor response to induction chemotherapy had worse prognosis. This is the current COG neuroblastoma study, which looks at the addition of I-131, MIBG, to high-risk backbone in high-risk patients, and in patients that have an ALK mutation or amplification, they're adding crizotinib, and this happens in about 14% of patients. So this is the radiation treatment guidelines. The dose to a patient that's had a gross total resection in the abdomen is 21.6 gray. It is controversial whether or not we should be boosting to 36 gray. I am still using the boost to 36 gray for gross residual disease, but there has been a COG memo saying that you didn't have to, as there's no benefit to it. And the lead author in the ASTRO presentation is a rock star resident of ours, Kevin Liu. But there's some background on how we used to collect this information in COG that makes me a little bit suspicious that this could be maybe not the right way to go in the setting of highly conformal radiotherapy. But this is an evolving story and we'll move forward. It will evolve as we move forward. Mets that do not respond completely by the time induction chemotherapy is over do need to be topped up to 21.6 gray. Thank you for bearing with me through all this information. There are so many more slides that are online, and you can cover more at your leisure. And thank you to the organizers and for shifting gears and making this a virtual platform. Stay safe, everyone, and keep others safe. And hopefully we'll get to meet in person next year. Take care.